Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Limelight.
A persistent concern over homeschooling as a result of COVID-19 has been that it is causing new inequalities in children's education. The closure of schools means children's learning has relied increasingly on their family's social and domestic circumstances. The pandemic has shown that the poorest families in the UK do not have access to the resources necessary to educate children at home. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article authored by Martin Myers under the heading, Homeschooling Links with Inequality Are Far From New. This article has appeared on the front page of fees.org. Please stay with us to hear more about this issue. In 2020, the coronavirus pandemic has made homeschooling a fact of life. Though even before this, what was once the obscure choice of a few families has grown in popularity over the past decade. In 2019, the Children's Commissioner for England estimated that around 60,000 children were homeschooled. A persistent concern over homeschooling as a result of COVID-19 has been that it is causing new inequalities in children's education. The closure of schools means children's learning has relied increasingly on their family's social and domestic circumstances. The pandemic has shown that the poorest families in the UK do not have access to the resources necessary to educate children at home. But focusing on the effects of the pandemic overlooks two important and interconnected points. The first is that persistent educational inequalities are a feature of schools too. The second is that schools and homeschooling operate in close relation to each other. Martin Myers wrote, "My research has found that inequality has long been a feature of homeschooling, and this often stems from inequalities in schools." One of the clearest examples of the links between inequalities in school and homeschooling is off-rolling, when schools informally persuade parents to homeschool their children. Off-rolling can be attractive to schools because, in principle, it means limited resources such as teacher time are not squandered on difficult individual pupils. It is difficult to identify the number of pupils who have been off-rolled. But research by the UK's Education Inspection Body, the Office for Standards in Education, suggests that that is on the rise. The Ofsted findings also indicate that off-rolling was mostly initiated by senior leaders in secondary schools to remove children with behavioral problems, poor attendance, and special educational needs. The research has found that children most likely to be off-rolled were often ethnic minority and poorer backgrounds. They are a mirror image of the children who always seem to be let down in schools. For example, racist stereotypes about gypsy and travel children often identify them as difficult, problematic pupils unlikely to succeed academically. As the children most likely to be excluded from schools, their educational outcomes are very poor. The evidence of poor results is itself cited to justify racist beliefs. Similar patterns emerge around other ethnic groups and working class pupils. These biases held by senior school leaders inform decisions to off-roll some pupils, supposedly protect the academic performance of the whole school. Off-rolling is an example of how educational inequalities within schools lead to some poorer ethnic minority pupils becoming homeschooled. Their limited access to money and other resources compromises their education both in and out of schools. Before the pandemic, media accounts of parents making the choice of homeschool often emphasize positive stories. Typically, these portray affluent families embarking on an existing adventure and taking back control of their children's education. Unlike the families of children who are off-rolled, these families have greater financial security and other resources that make such life-changing decisions possible. Though for many families, the choice to take their children out of school is no choice at all. Instead, it is a response to problems over which they have no control. Commonplace examples include the families of children who experience racism in schools that refuse to acknowledge that racism exists in their classrooms, and those of children with special educational needs that are not matched by school support. These families describe homeschooling as a better option for their children, but not the best option. The author of this article said they often struggle with limited access to resources and identify the best option as mainstream schooling that could meet their children's educational needs. This brings us to the nub of the problems facing families in the lockdown. Many families have limited resources. Mardin noted, in 2020, during the first lockdown and after the closure of schools and cancellation of exams, I was involved in research conducted by the Universities of Nottingham and Birmingham to carry out a survey of more than 500 A-level students studying at home. He added, our preliminary studies, new research which has not yet been published in a peer-reviewed journal, suggests that students from ethnic minorities, poorer backgrounds, and state schools were most fearful that the cancellation of exams would negatively affect their grades. They pointed out that inequalities associated with race and ethnicity, as well as family income, affected their experience of schooling in the past as well as homeschooling in the present. Martin concluded this research predated the A-level grade moderation scandal, in which students from disadvantaged backgrounds and ethnic minorities tended to receive worse results, while students at private schools benefited from the moderation process. It was striking that the students in our research anticipated and predicted the unfairness of this process. He added, if nothing else, COVID-19 has demonstrated that homeschooling does not exist in isolation. It is enmeshed in broader educational practice, social life, and all their associated inequalities. It is too easy to view inequalities that have materialized for homeschool children now as an unfortunate and unforeseen consequence of the pandemic.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
People who limit the Quran to worshipping and personal matters haven't understood it. This is a part of a speech delivered on April 14, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, at the annual Ramadan Quranic meeting. The speech was delivered via video conference with the participation of a number of prominent Quranic reciters.
The Americans want to negotiate in order to impose their own legitimate demands. You should notice that when the Americans continuously speak of their willingness to directly negotiate with Iran, it is not the case that their intention is to accept a legitimate claim. Rather, their purpose for negotiating is to impose an illegitimate claim. Actually, that is what they always do. They do not want to listen to and to accept a truthful claim. In their private meetings with our officials, whose reports are delivered to us by our officials, the Europeans acknowledge that Iran is right about its policy, that the sanctions should be lifted first. We announced that the sanctions have to be lifted first. This is because we are not sure about their promises, as they have broken their promises tens of times already, and as it happens, they sometimes even acted in the exact opposite way. In the present time too, they will do the same. Therefore, they should first do what we ask so that we feel assured of it, and then we will carry out our obligations. Sometimes European negotiators confirm in private meetings that what Iran says is correct and the Iranians are right. But when it comes to decision making, they follow in their America's footsteps. They are not really independent in any way. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu As for the Americans, they have a bullying attitude and they have the tendency to impose their demands. This is their issue. Therefore, the proposals that they put forward are so arrogant and humiliating that one cannot even look at. I hope that by Allah's favor, the officials of the country will move forward with completely open eyes, with a firm heart, with reliance on God, and by whispering the dhikr. For us, Allah suffices, and He is the best disposer of affairs. I hope that God will bestow His blessings on them so that they will make the nation happy. I hope that Allah the Exalted will bestow His blessings and will shower His rain of mercy on our dry and thirsty lands, and that He will confer His worldly and otherworldly blessings on the masses of the people and the mujahids of the path of the truth. I hope that He will associate the immaculate soul of our magnanimous Imam with His saints, that He will associate the pure souls of martyrs with the martyrs of the early Islamic era, that He will send our sincere greetings and sympathies to the Mawla of the world, the Imam of the age. May our hearts be sacrificed for His sake, and that He will help us gain the satisfaction of that esteemed personality and benefit from His prayers. The greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. To Allah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Electricity is only 20% of our total energy use. Renewable electricity has not displaced fossil energy in most countries because our consumption increases faster than we can add renewable generation. We now present you an article authored by Mike Joy, a senior researcher at the Institute for Governance and Policy Studies at Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand. The piece is titled, "The Idea of Green Growth is Flawed." The article has been published by the Conversation website. Please stay with us for more of Mike Joy's article. As countries explore ways of decarbonizing their economies, the mantra of green growth risks trapping us in a spiral of failures. Green growth is an oxymoron. Growth requires more material extraction, which in turn requires more energy. The fundamental problem we face in trying to replace fossil energy with renewable energy is that all our renewable technologies are significantly less energy dense than fossil fuels. This means much larger areas are required to produce the same amount of energy. Early this year, data from the European Union showed renewable electricity generation has overtaken coal and gas in 2020. But previous research argued that to replace the total energy, not just electricity, use of the UK with the best available mix of wind, solar and hydroelectricity would require the entire landmass of the country. To do it for Singapore would require the area of 60 Singapores. I am not in any way denying or diminishing the need to stop emitting fossil carbon. But if we don't focus on reducing consumption and energy waste, and instead fixate on replacing fossil fuels with renewable energy, we are simply swapping one race to destruction with another race to destruction. The carbon causing our climate problem today came from fossilized biology formed through ancient carbon cycles, mostly over the 200 million years of the Mesozoic era, ending 66 million years ago. We must stop burning fossil fuels, but we must also understand that every technology to replace them, while attempting to maintain our current consumption, let alone allowing for consumption growth, requires huge amounts of fossil energy. Carbon reduction without consumption reduction is only possible through methods that have their own massive environmental impacts and resource limitations. To make renewable energy, fossil energy is needed to mine the raw materials, to transport, to manufacture, to connect the energy capture systems, and finally to produce the machines to use the energy. The new renewable infrastructure requires rare earth minerals, which is a problem in itself. But most of the raw materials required to produce and apply new energy technology are also getting harder to find. The returns on mining them are reducing, and the dilemma of declining returns applies to the very fossil fuels needed to mine the declining metal ore. Globally, despite building lots of renewable electricity infrastructure, we have not yet increased the proportion of renewable energy in our total energy consumption. Electricity is only 20% of our total energy use. Renewable electricity has not displaced fossil energy in most countries because our consumption increases faster than we can add renewable generation. The problems with wanting to maintain industrial civilization are many, but the starkest is that it is the actual cause of our climate crisis and other environmental crises. If we carry on with life as usual, the underlying dream of the green growth concept, we will end up destroying the life-supporting capacity of our planet. The green growth concept is part of a broader and long-running trend to co-opt the words green and environmentalist. Environmentalism emerged from the 1960s as a movement to save the natural world. Now it seems to have been appropriated to describe the fight to save industrial civilization. Life as we know it on planet Earth. This shift has serious implications because the two concepts, green growth and environmentalism, are inherently incompatible. Traditionally, environmentalists included people like Rachel Carson, whose 1962 book Silent Spring alerted Americans to the industrial poisons killing birds and insects and fouling drinking water, or environmental organizations like Greenpeace, saving whales and baby seals. In New Zealand, being green had its roots in movements like the Save Manapouri campaign, which fought to save ancient native forests from inundation when a hydropower dam was built. Environmentalism had a clear focus on saving the living world. Now environmentalism has been realigned to reduce carbon emissions, as if climate change were our only impending crisis. We must somehow drag ourselves away from our growth paradigm to tackle the multiple crises coming at us. Our only future is one where we consume less, we do less, waste less, and stop our obsession with accumulating. If we keep trying to maintain our current growth trajectory, built on a one-off fossil bonanza, we will destroy the already stressed life-supporting systems that sustain us on this planet. Protecting these and their essential biotic components is true environmentalism, not attempting to maintain our industrial way of life just without carbon.
Hello.
landmark report released recently put coal and gas on notice. For the first time, the International Energy Agency, the IEA, declared reaching net zero emissions by 2050 means no new investments in fossil fuel supply projects. For Australia, a continent blessed with a bounty of wind and sun, the phasing out of coal and gas investment should be considered a boon. Australia is already deploying wind and solar energy 10 times faster than the global average and still has plenty of unmet renewable potential. But of course, Australia's path to a clean energy economy has not been perfectly smooth. A lack of federal leadership on climate policy and a historical dependence on fossil fuels means the International Energy Agency's roadmap presents a big challenge for Australia. Our latest report recently underscores how big a challenge this is. We assess Australia's highest emitting energy firms and found none were fully or even closely aligned with global climate goals. Just one firm went even part way, and five appeared to be taking no action at all. Our energy sector report forms part of the Net Zero Momentum Tracker, a project by research organization Climate Works, which works within the Monash Sustainable Development Institute. We assess the commitments of Australia's 20 highest emitting energy companies against the Paris Climate Agreement goals, which include limiting global temperature rise to well below 2 degrees Celsius, aiming for 1.5 degrees Celsius. The International Energy Agency's latest work shows to reach those goals, the global energy sector must reach net zero carbon emissions by 2050. The companies we analyze compromise electricity generators and electricity and gas retailers. Together, they account for almost one-third of Australia's total annual emissions. Each company's commitments were assessed against scenarios we modelled, which mapped the least cost trajectories for reducing Australia's carbon emissions in line with the Paris Climate Accord goals. We found no large energy company was fully aligned with these trajectories, and most fell well short of them. Six had set carbon emission reduction targets, and nine others had taken some action to cut carbon emissions. However, not a single company had commitments that are in line with Australia achieving net zero carbon emissions by 2050. The energy sector is crucial if Australia is to meet the Paris climate goals. Thanks to renewable energy, the sector enjoys some of the easiest and cheapest emission reduction opportunities. And a zero carbon emission energy sector would also help other sectors such as transportation, buildings and industry to decarbonize. At a federal level, the renewable energy target, which ended last year, drove the clean energy shift. New federal policies are now needed to bolster ambitious state and territory policies. This would enable energy market operators and investors to plan a transition aligned with the Paris Climate Accord goals.
The debate.
Hello, everyone. The United Nations top rights body has agreed to launch an investigation into crimes committed during the recent Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Palestinians have welcomed the decision by the UN Human Rights Council. Before the adoption of the resolution on Thursday, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said that the Deadly Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip caused widespread destruction of civilian infrastructure and fatalities, and they might constitute war crimes. Israel rejected the UN Rights Body's decision, saying that it would not cooperate with the probe. Throughout the 11-day encounter, Israeli airstrikes killed at least 254 Palestinians, including 66 children, wounded almost 2,000, and displaced over 72,000 people. On the other side, Palestinian retaliatory attacks killed 12 people in the occupied territories. Our correspondent Asher Shannon is joining us now from Gaza to bring us up to speed on the humanitarian situation in the aftermath of the Israeli onslaught on the besieged Gaza Strip. Ashraf?
Well, but yeah, the humanitarian situation in the besieged enclave is the worst ever under the Israeli occupation, under Israeli blockade, as Israel continues to exert pressure on international agencies in order for them not to bring in aid and supplies into the enclave. They're trying to block the entry of humanitarian aid, and also that such aid includes hospital supplies, surgical supplies, and all sorts of needed equipment to help look for survivors, possible survivors under the rubble. Still, rescue crews are working round the clock since day one of the Israeli onslaught to try and find if there are more victims or more martyrs or wounded, and the possibility of finding people alive under the rubble is very slim.
All right, thanks a lot. That was our correspondent, Asher Shannon, joining us from the Gaza Strip. Joining us on this debate, we have journalist and political analyst Julia Kassem joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also, historian and journalist Brecht Jonkers is joining us from Hasselt, Belgium. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Ms. Kassem in Beirut. The top UN human rights body has voted to create an open-ended international investigation into Israel's treatment of Palestinians. As we mentioned earlier, the Palestinian Authority said the decision amounts to international recognition of Israel's systemic oppression and discrimination against the Palestinian people. How do you view this decision?
So we saw more consensus being reached this year on an ICC measure to investigate Israel for past war crimes. Just as kind of we're seeing right now, the UN taking steps to take an investigation into the mass murder by the occupation of Gazans. But at the same time, we have to, of course, be realistic on if this is going to translate into any real accountability or action against the occupation and against the onslaught it has caused onto Gazans. We remember in 2014, the UN also did an investigation and also did a report. But what the report turned out is that it rehashed the both sides narrative. It rehashed putting Hamas at fault as well. And this is absolutely not true. Hamas is just and all resistance forces that have worked out of Gaza and that have resisted the attacks from the occupation were just in self-defense, striking military targets, production facilities. And so both we just know of the UN that, first of all, it's obviously in the hands of the Western powers, and works essentially to their advantage and inclines towards capital, not human rights. So we're not going to really see any action. And even the condemnations that will come out are not going to reflect the disproportionate force and injustice that is represented every single time this illegal occupation slaughters Gazans.
Brecht Jonkers, let's pick up on what our guest in Beirut just mentioned. There have been UN-led investigations in the past, most notably on Gaza. Will this one be any different?
Well, I guess for a major part, we just have to wait and see. But I think it is a very good point to make that we should always temper our expectations when it comes to the United Nations doing anything. And because this so-called international community, as translated in the UN, has very often proven in the past to be relatively toothless and incapable or unwilling to make any lasting decisions or any major changes to the status quo as it exists now. That being said, I think it is important, of course, to point out the developments that are going in a positive direction and that somewhat give us that can give us hope to continue the struggle for the future. Because I think it goes without saying that it's due to the national resistance of the Palestinians and the international work of the worldwide Palestine solidarity movement in general that has pressured so many countries in the world to eventually now support or at least abstain from the vote that was made in the UN Human Rights Council. Because when we see, of course, major nations such as China and Russia backing this proposal, which is one of the most, clear voiced condemnations of Israel that we have seen in the history of the United Nations, or at least for the past decades. And we see a lot of Western countries that are members of this Human Rights Council that you would normally expect to vote against it, such as France and Poland, for example, that who now have abstained for what I believe for a major part due to the fact that they know that there is a major international pressure, including people in their own countries, especially in countries such as France, of course, from the Muslim population and from the general population who opposes imperialism and supports human rights, that blocking a motion such as was made here by the Organization of Islamic Unity and by Pakistan, suggested by Pakistan here, that blocking this motion would be a completely unacceptable deed to do. Secondly, one other historical change is that this commission of inquiry, which was created now by the Human Rights Council, is the first ever commission of inquiry that has an ongoing permanent task. This means that they are set to investigate specifically starting these 11 days of conflict that have existed the past month. But they are looking for what happened these 11 days, but also what led up to it in general. And they are tasked with continuously monitoring the further human rights violations that could be committed by, could have been committed and will be committed potentially by the Zionist entity. So this is for the first time that the Commission of Inquiry has a ongoing, permanent, continuous task. There is no, date of ending this commission. There is no real, expiry date for this. And the third one is that the commission is specifically founded according to the text that was passed by the council. This commission is founded to investigate all human rights violations committed in the Palestinian territories and in Israel itself, in what the Zionist entity itself. So this means that this will not just be, if it goes according to plan, the work of this commission will not just be limited to Gaza and to the West Bank and to East Jerusalem, but can also be used in general for human rights violations that happen within the borders of the Zionist entity as it has existed since 1967, or even since 1948, basically. So there is no part of Zionist occupation that will be absolved from commission inquiry. Of course, we still have to wait and see how effective and how efficient this commission will really be, but these three steps is something that would never have happened at all were it not for the pressure of the Palestinians and for the international Indeed. Palestine solidarity movement. And so I think that by itself is already a victory.
Ms. Qasem, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said the Ademi airstrikes in such densely populated areas of Gaza resulted in a high level of civilian fatalities and injuries and may constitute war crimes if they are deemed to be indiscriminate and disproportionate in their impact on civilians. Well, in my opinion, the answers are already there when schools and media offices and medical facilities are targeted, when defenseless women and children are murdered. What more needs to be seen?
Exactly. The evidence is already there. In every single investigation or in every single attack on Gaza, it's been the same. Civilian infrastructure has been targeted. all kinds of infrastructure, including media infrastructure, schools, hospitals. They've all been the targets of Israeli war crimes, and everyone could see that despite the Zionist entities' attempted obfuscation of that through the targeting of the media offices, which spoke in itself. You know, it was just apparent, and the evidence is just out there, and everybody recognizes that not only was the impact disproportionate, but it was completely criminal and obvious that there was a deliberate attack on civilians once again. Thankfully, the forward move from this resolution does show that there's going to be more of a condemnation and more of an investigation that's going to emphasize that too. It looks like just as the Palestinian resistance has put the Zionist entity on the defensive militarily, this investigation also will put the Zionist occupation on the defensive in the context of its human rights violations too. The United States and Israel have for too long enjoyed the having almost impunity in the eyes of the UN, whereas you know, clearly they were violating multiple human rights violations and resolutions, I believe 65. With the change in attitude globally that is reflected in this resolution and in the global attitude towards the Zionist entity, we are going to see some pressure moving forth. It's also worth mentioning that from the West and the Zionist entity's defensiveness in wanting to abstain from voting on this or even voting no, the Zionist entity is also losing their impunity in their narrative, even in the realm of international human rights organizations like the UN. It's definitely looking positive that there is going to be accountability, not necessarily from the UN itself, but because of the successes coming from the Palestinian resistance and also from its the allies to this motion, which include countries like China and Russia, which seem to also have more leverage in their condemnations and in their vote than previously.
Brecht Yonkers, Michelle Bachelet cautioned that violence could erupt again unless the quote-unquote root causes are addressed. I think the plural form of that word is a bit redundant here. What is the root cause other than the illegal occupation of Palestinian land by the Israeli regime?
I think you hit the nail on the head there. That is indeed basically the main cause to start it all. And that is, again, an interesting matter, because when you see the responses, the livid responses by the Israeli delegates in the United Nations, by the Zionist Prime Minister Netanyahu, and of course the even more radical people in the Zionist politics, such as Avigdor Lieberman, you see that their absolute meltdowns of responses often include an attempt to turn around the causality, which they have of course been doing for decades already, basically as long as Palestinian resistance has been around. They have always said, we are just defending ourselves from these rocket attacks, from these terrorist attacks, as they call it, from these what they believe to be Arabs who are anti-Semitic somehow, who don't want Jews in the land, etc. But people are starting to wake up more and more, and even now in the United Nations, you see that people are kind of, they're maybe not condemning, especially Western politicians and Western public opinion is not outright maybe condemning Israel for its core existence as a colonial settler entity, but at least they are rejecting, or at least quietly disregarding, the idea that Israel is merely defending itself, that Israel is merely responding, because people start to wake up, of course, to the fact that this all basically started with a colonialist project that began basically as far back as the Balfour Declaration of 1917 and really kicked off in 1948 after the British basically handed over the land as a silver platter to Zionist settlers. And ever since then, of course, there has been a constant cycle of violence that is not, maybe not really a cycle, but it's more like, you know, Zionist colonization and legitimate native indigenous response by the Palestinians to this colonization. So when the, it's again, it's a step forward when Michel Bachelet, a UN man, a functionary, says we have to look at the root causes. Of course, they still say causes. They keep it, let's say, politically correct. But they, the fact that they want to look at not just what happened in 2021, not just what happened now in the attack, but they want to look at how did it come there. And when you want to look at how did it come there, you have to look at Sheikh Jarrah, you have to look at East Jerusalem, you have to look at what happened with Al-Aqsa. And of course, you have to look at why is Gaza a besieged territory in the first place. And then you look at the elections of 2006 in which the Palestinians were denied the right basically to express their vote freely, or they expressed their votes, but since then were punished for it because apparently they were not allowed to have a democracy. This way you can start step by step, hopefully, go back in time until you really see, you reach and undeniably show to the world, I hope, that the root cause is, as you said, Zionist colonization.
Julia Qassem, let's cross over now to events unfolding in the West Bank. Amnesty International recently said Israel must immediately halt the eviction of Palestinians from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Anybody with half a brain knows that this is clearly not a real estate dispute, and under international law, the Israeli judicial system has no legal authority over the population that it occupies. Well, why is it still continuing then?
Because of its failures. Israel gets more and more aggressive every time it fails. And it failed militarily in this recent campaign. But what motivated Sheikh Jarrah was its frustration over its failure over the deal of the century. It didn't win with the Palestinian people. In fact, you begin to see from the time of the collapse of the deal of the century, factions in the West Bank and in Gaza working more in unity. Now we can finally see the beginning stages of the collapse of the PLO and the PA as the comprador authorities since Oslo that have basically coordinated with Israel on arresting Palestinians and containing and holding the West Bank, essentially. So right now, in order to basically completely annex every single last piece of the West Bank, which was a project that has always been, carried out by Israel since 1948. Every single village was Sheikh Jarrah at some point, but especially accelerated after 2018 as part of Netanyahu and the Zionist entities. Push to aggressively take back all, completely colonize all of the West Bank. And this is also because of their failures in extending their fake borders. They never declared their borders to begin with because Greater Israel wanted to extend regionally. And the failure of their external campaigns over the years in Lebanon in 2006 and 2000 and in Syria, most recently, is causing them to channel that frustration inward. Everywhere you see the Zionist entity lashing out. It's lashing out and trying to, roll over hundreds and thousands of new settlements. Of course, it's always operated in impunity and still thinks it can get away with it. It's learning that it's very wrong in that regard. Right now, after the ceasefire, just 12 hours after the ceasefire was called, the Zionist occupying forces went back into Al-Aqsa and terrorized protesters. Right now, they're doing the same thing that they did in Sheikh Jarrah to Sirwan, like another village in Palestine.
Exactly.
So it's a sign of their losing strategy, but it's also a continuation of the violent settler colonialism and ethnic cleansing that began in earlier even than 1948, but officially recognized by the international community in 1948.
Brett Yonkers, I'm going to bring the same. Sorry to jump in there, Ms. Qassem. We're running short of time. One last question for Mr. Yonkers in Hasselt. I'm going to bring the same question to you. More land grab and evictions are being carried out by the Israeli regime. Palestinians in the town of Silwan, as Ms. Qasim just mentioned, in the occupied East Jerusalem, Al-Quds are facing new illegal expulsion threats similar to those in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Expelling an occupied people out of their homes in order to transfer the occupier's population into those homes is a war crime under international law. Why are these policies still continuing?
Yeah, I think I agree with Ms. Qasim about the core principle here. Indeed, there is the Zionist entity is becoming more and more of a cornered animal. But when you corner an animal, of course, it tries to strike back as much as it can, and it can grow in ferocity. And I think that is something that we have been seeing for a while now, especially the last couple of years. And this has also, I believe, caused the Zionists to really become more unhinged, let's say, in the things that they are doing. They see now that, you know, the eastern part of Al-Quds cannot just be bullied out of the hands of Palestinian people. Of course, they have been moving settlers in and bullying them and threatening them and even committing all sorts of aggression against them for years now. But now, of course, they are threatening to use judicial methods in order to, let's say, quote-unquote, legalize the de facto and the de jure expulsion of these people, because they are losing patience. Indeed, they are losing patience with the slow speed at which these things are going and with the tenacity of the Palestinians in resisting this.
Sure.
And this unhinged reaction by the Zionists has also, I think, be translated into the reason why they specifically attack the Al-Aqsa Masjid. So so far they have been trying for decades to say that Israel offers religious freedom and offers the Arabs, the Palestinians,
okay,
the chance to pray as Christians or Muslims, but now they are attacking the very sanctuaries of Islam itself as a consequence of their loss of patience and their unhinged response to it.
All right, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have for this program. Allow me to thank my guests, journalist and political analyst Julia Qasim, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Thanks to historian and journalist Brecht Jonkers, joining us from House of Belgium. And also special thanks to you for staying with us on Debate. Bye, everybody.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.